Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The primaries are over and November's general election is on the way. And along with the onset of this political season come campaign commercials. There's no stopping them. They'll be everywhere. And it's been that way on television since 1952.
I for president, I for president, I for president, I for president. You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Hang out the banner, beat the drum, we'll take Ike to Washington.
That's what political ads used to sound like. Bright, snappy, catchy.
Do you want a man for president who's seasoned through and through, but not so doggone seasoned that he won't try something new? A man who's old enough to know
and young enough to do.
Well, it's up to you, it's up to you, it's strictly up to you.
Well, we've come a long way since then, moving away from catchy tunes to something more serious and somber, even calm attempts to instill confidence.
It's morning again in America. And under the leadership of President Reagan, our country is prouder and stronger and better. Why would we ever want to return to where we were less than four short years ago?
No yelling, no name-calling, only an oblique criticism of the other guy in the race. Who was the other guy? Fast forward a couple of decades, and we end up here.
In this election, we each face a question. What kind of country do we want to live in? There are some people who think we should be a country of chaos, of fear, of hate. But us, we choose something different. We choose freedom.
Freedom, freedom, I can't move. Freedom, cut me loose.
And, of course, the counterpoint to that.
Kamala supports transgender sex changes in jail with our money.
Kamala even supports letting biological men compete against our girls in their sports. Kamala is for they, them. President Trump is for you.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
And that's mild. So here we are in the moments before campaigns start gearing up for November in the state in which the most money ever spent on a Senate race is likely to be doled out. And the bulk of that money will go to advertising. Get ready. You're going to be hit with a lot of it. But in a country where people are so entrenched, where they have planted their flags, either red or blue, where elections are decided on increasingly small margins, how effective is advertising? I mean, really, what kind of ads work and what messages have any chance of changing minds? Michael Bitzer is with us. He's a professor of politics and history and director of the Center for North Carolina Politics and Public Service at Catawba College. And we welcome back Jacob Neuheisel. He is a professor, associate professor of political science at the University at Buffalo. Good morning to both of you. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
I guess I should say welcome back because you've both been here before. And Jacob, I'm going to start with you because in 1952, the world was different. It was softer, more genteel. Things began to change, I guess, during the Vietnam era. But even President Nixon's commercials were serious. They were polite. They were presidential. But presidential campaign ads, as most ads at all levels, have become more biting, more cutting, brutal in some cases. Is that a reflection of our politics or a reflection of the coarsening of the culture at large?
That's a fantastic question. I think a bit of all of the above might be the appropriate answer. But I would note that negativity has always been with us. You know, if you look at the Lincoln-Douglas debates, they weren't exactly the most highbrow or high-minded rhetoric. And, you know, in between Ike for President and It's Morning in America, we also had Johnson's Daisy ad that, you know, was more oblique, but it suggested that his opponent was going to nuke the world. And so we've always had some measure of negativity in campaigns. It does feel like it's something that has ratcheted up quite a bit. It's hard to quantify, but the nastiness of the attack seems to have been something that's been on the rise in recent years. And I think that may be a reflection of both our polarized political environment and also maybe a culture at large, where it's just harder to cut through the mix and you need something that is truly eye-catching or ear-catching to get through to people. So a little bit of everything.
Michael, I've always been told, that I've heard many times, that North Carolina's politics is rough and tumble, perhaps an extension of our political advertising, or vice versa. I don't know which way it goes. Would you say that's true? And if so, why?
I would say that's true. And I think the reason why is the fact that we have such a large portion of our electorate that is baked in, loyal to one party. They are not moving. It's what we would call the calcification of our electorate. It has become very rigid. Both sides can basically count on 45, 46, as we get closer to general election day, 47%. That leaves a very small portion of the electorate that could move one way or the other, the persuadables. And so the advertising is, I think, in this state at least, kind of twofold. One is, yeah, let's reach out, let's try and get those persuadables. You know, it's easier to scare somebody than it is to necessarily motivate them in a positive manner. But then you've got the other side, you've got the bulk of the electorate, and they need to be energized. They need to be mobilized. They need to get out and show up at the ballot box. And so I think advertising is probably going to be that dual strain of dynamics in this state.
Jacob, you may have alluded to this in the answer to your first question, but let's dig a little deeper into it, because it seems to people of a certain age, mine to be exact, that our ads have become angry and bitter and hateful. Our politics has become the same way. And we think of that as a modern invention, but really, is it? I mean, is what we live through in terms of the radio commercials, political radio commercials of the 1940s and the TV commercials of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, was that an aberration? Are we actually returning to something that was more common in our politics?
That's a fantastic question as well. I think the answer to that is yes. The 50s and 60s or early 1960s, which is, by the way, precisely the time when political scientists were coming up with trying to be general theories of how politics in America work, that was an aberration. That was a time when, you know, some observers talked about four-party politics in America. You had liberal and conservative wings in both major parties. And as a result of that, there were usually some things that they could do to cobble together a coalition, and politics was not quite as polarized as it is today. And frankly, in the period immediately preceding that point in time, you know, the late 19th century was a very polarized political era as well, and you saw very nasty politics as a result. So this is something I always tell people when I'm doing talks in the community here is, you know, we remember things as being better at one point, and that might be true. But if we take the long view, negativity and you know, very, very negative politics is a prominent feature in America. And, you know, this is a return to the norm, not an aberration.
Yeah, it goes back. There's some nasty things said between John Adams and his opponent, and Thomas Jefferson and
Jefferson,
his opponent. And of course, the late 19th century was just replete with attacks of one candidate to the other. Michael, you're the historian here. Was this aberration, this calmness, due to the post-war era in which America felt on top of the world, and we won World War II, and we were prosperous, probably the only real prosperous democracy in the world, because we were in the process of rebuilding Europe, etc. Was that what led to this little break in the angriness and the vitriol of our politics and our political advertising?
Yeah, I think certainly the dynamic that America found itself in as a world leader after World War II and the beginning of the Cold War, it became an us versus them, the United States versus the Soviet Union. So we had a kind of common threat against the country, and that, I would say, played a part in it. Now, you know, we did have negativism. We had the McCarthy Red Scare dynamics at the same time. But I think, you know, as Jacob noted, you know, at that time, particularly political scientists looking at the two political parties, they basically said there wasn't a dime's worth of difference between the two parties. Then they advocated the parties need to stand for discrete and dynamic things that are opposite from the other side to give voters a choice. Well, guess what? We've got choice, clear choices nowadays. Be careful what you ask for, because then those choices lead to definitive differences in terms of how both parties are looking at policies and issues. And it also opens up the opportunity to say, hey, you don't necessarily want to vote for my party, but you sure as heck fire don't want to vote for that other party. Negative partisanship, the affective polarization that we as political scientists understand.
We're talking about politics and political advertising on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I agree with you that there is a big difference between the two parties, but there are a lot of voters out there, Jacob, who say there's not a dime's worth of difference between any of them. And that, in part, I think, has led to where we are. There's no question there, just a statement.
I think in some ways that's right. There are a lot of voters are expressing dissatisfaction with the parties, but it's kind of costless to do that in the context of a survey that we would give them. When the rubber meets the road, when they're in the voting booth, they tend to pull the lever for the party that they're closely identified with at rates that we've not seen in quite some time. You know, you're having 90%+ of Republicans and Democrats both voting for the nominee of their party, even if they say that they don't like them. And so I think that you're seeing this point where, yeah, we don't love it, but the alternative is somehow worse in our minds. And so we will pull that lever for, you know, whoever we think is best. You know, even if we don't really like our choices.
Michael, we've talked, maybe you and I have talked, but certainly we've talked in with other folks on this program over the years about attack ads and why people continue to use them, why candidates and their campaigns continue to use them. Why would a candidate choose to attack their opponent as opposed to using that very expensive airtime to say, here's what I'm about, I'm going to make life great for you. Vote for me. Why?
I think you kind of see at times both being utilized in an advertisement. You know, it's kind of, hi, I'm running for office. This is what I think. But then they do this sharp pivot and do the attack of the other side. And so, yes, advertising is expensive. They want to get the most out of it. Again, I kind of go back to, is it easier to, you know, share the joy and the love and, you know, the promise and the positivity, or do you want to scare the bejeebas out of somebody and get them motivated? Because, you know, scaring somebody, giving them a threat, putting fear into them, that can be a real motivator in terms of the dynamics of who's going to show up.
Jacob, I only have a minute left. Which works better, the positive ad or the negative attack ad?
Well, we tend to think that negativity works. It works by, you know, the same mechanism that you see a car wreck and you look to see what's going on. It's ooh, a fight. And so they tend to draw more attention. They tend to be more emotive. And they also tend to actually contain more policy relevant information for precisely the reason that Michael was talking about, which is that there usually is a pivot in these contrast ads. There's the attack portion, and then there's here's what I'm going to do. And they tend to have more information about discrete policy information. So, that's why.
Jacob Neuhausel is an associate professor of political science at the University at Buffalo. He's here with Michael Bitzer, professor of politics and history and director of the Center for North Carolina Politics and Public Service at Catawba College. We're continuing in the moment. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about political advertising and the tenor of those ads and the tenor of our politics with two experts on the subject, Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of politics and history and the director for the Center for North Carolina Politics and Public Service at Catawba College, and Dr. Jacob Neuheisel, an associate professor of political science at the University at Buffalo. Jacob, the little snippet of the one of the Trump commercials that aired during the last presidential cycle that I played earlier in the program talked about Vice President Harris's support for transgender people. And it started this way with popular radio personality Charlemagne the God. And then he segues into a clip of an interview with Harris herself.
Kamala supports taxpayer-funded sex changes for prisoners.
Surgery.
For prisoners.
For prisoners. Every transgender inmate in the prison system would have access.
Hell no, I don't want my taxpayer dollars going to that.
So there are likely voters who pulled the lever for Donald Trump because of that commercial and because she actually is in that commercial substantiating what Charlemagne the God just accused her of saying. She said what she said in the commercial. It didn't seem to work, however, in the opposite direction. There were Kamala Harris commercials where President Trump was quoted saying things that he said, and it didn't work. Why not?
That's a great question, and it's something political science is still working on. The most recent evidence we have on this is that, you know, there isn't one thing that always works in a campaign. And I think that the more you think about that, that probably should be true. Campaigns should be a conversation. Campaigns should be about what's going on in the moment. And so there are no features of ads that are forever and always effective. This is one of the number one questions I get asked in these kinds of conversations is what works? And the answer is lots of things can work. It just depends on the context and depends on, you know, where the electorate is at that time point. And the campaigns are always trying to find where that is. And the electorate is very fickle. They can change very quickly. In the midterms running up to the, you know, in the 2022 midterms, abortion was that issue that seemed to work very, very well. In 2024, that did not work all that well, and other things did. So it's very context dependent.
Well, that was my next question, because that ad was very effective, and it was about transgender rights, which is a darling of the right at the moment. But this came at a time, Michael, when voters said that their most pressing issues were the economy and reproductive rights. What does that tell you about messaging?
I think messaging, as Jacob kind of articulated, is this. There's almost multiple messages going on, that there can be micro-targeting to specific audiences, to specific types of voters. You know, if the electorate is so rigid, if we're kind of baked into our partisan corners, and, you know, the candidates and their campaigns know we're not going to move a whole lot of people, but if we can identify slices of the electorate and push narratives to activate them, I think that's where the complexity of trying to understand, well, it was this issue, no, it was that issue. There are multiple issues. You know, there's complexity in terms of the voters and what they care about. And certainly the polls indicate the economy is always top of the issue. Then you get into very select, you know, policy issues that appeal to one side over the other. But campaigns are kind of focusing now on the micro dynamics to be able to move the needle a little bit could have huge consequences at the polls.
So how might that, we're about to enter in the most expensive Senate campaign in history, allegedly, in the race between former Democratic Governor Roy Cooper in North Carolina and former Republican State Committee Chair and RNC Chair Michael Whatley. How ugly might this get in the coming months, Dr. Bitzer?
Batten down the hatches, get your galoshes, your raincoats, umbrellas, everything. It's going to be descending upon us. And I would not be surprised if we start to see kind of the soft rollout of advertising, not just by the candidates and their campaigns, but by surrogates, by third parties, by special interest groups. They're going to start, you know, testing the waters here in North Carolina. We've got, you know, about 8 months to go, but that's a long time to set things up and start getting narratives out there. It'll really start descending come Labor Day, but I wouldn't be surprised if you start seeing some kinds of ads popping up here and there, getting some testing done by various groups to see what's going to work come September or October.
Jacob, you are nodding vigorously.
Yes. I did a little homework. So I looked at the FCC public inspection files before today, and you know, Michael is absolutely right. There's nothing in the way of candidate advertising in the top three media markets in North Carolina yet, but there are some issue ads. Now, I wasn't able to look at them, but there are some contracts out there for issue ads already. And when I see issue ad, I think a attack ad by any other name. And so that's what we're it's coming, and it's coming fast.
And yet we saw a kind of a shift in the way politics is normally done recently with the election in the primary election in Texas, where he's running for a Texas Senate seat, James Tallarico, and he won that race against fellow Democrat Jasmine Crockett. Crockett can be fiery and very outspoken. Tallarico, I believe, is a Baptist minister, and he took a calm, educated, even preacher-like approach. He quoted scripture as part of his campaign. He beat her. So can you take that same approach in a general election? Can your campaign advertising, Dr. Neuheisel, take that same approach, even in the face of the more typical ads that will likely come Tallarico's way from the other side and still win that contest?
Well, it's a great question. Yes, but it depends. And so it depends on the dynamics of the race. You know, that was what was necessary at that point in time. A lot of this feels a bit too deterministic, but we have to think that the campaigns are doing message testing along the way. They're doing focus groups. They're doing what they can to figure out what works and what doesn't. And so as outside observers who aren't in the thick of the campaign, we have to kind of infer that they're putting their best foot forward at all times. And so if we're seeing it, that's what their message testing is suggesting is going to work. So it might work there. But in a different context, say North Carolina, you might have a very different tenor to the campaign, and that's all based off of their own internals.
Go ahead, Mike.
And the only thing I would say is we don't have a Republican candidate in Texas yet. That's gone to a primary.
Right.
And if particularly Ken Paxton defeats the incumbent, John Cornyn, I think that race is going to be fascinating to watch because Paxton will basically go, if I have to predict, highly negative. How the Democrat will respond and the dynamics there is going to be a fascinating case study for those of us that watch this kind of thing.
Michael, we couldn't find any Roy Cooper for Senate campaign ads yet. They may be out there. We just haven't found them. But what we do have is his social media video message announcing his decision to run for Senate. It appeared on a platform that didn't exist not too long ago. It was nearly 2.5 minutes long. We have excerpted it to give you an idea of the approach that the former governor chose to use.
It wasn't always this hard because being in the middle class meant something. You could afford a home. Your kids went to good schools. Your job paid enough to cover the basics, and most summers you could get away for a few days. For the most part, life was pretty good. I'm Roy Cooper. I've thought on it and prayed about it, and I've decided I want to serve as your next United States Senator.
Of course, he elaborated on how things used to be, how they should be, how he would work to put things back together the way they used to be. Morning in America again. Make America great again. It's the same theme. He was tugging at heartstrings. He never alluded to an opponent because there wasn't one at the moment, although the presumptive nominee was going to be Michael Whatley. And he mentioned praying on it, almost a James Tallarico approach. Mm-hmm. Would he be wise to continue that approach as his advertising rolls out? Can that approach work in a general election against a Republican? Because he was running against Democrats.
Yeah, I think, you know, for federal office in North Carolina, this state leans slightly Republican. So if you're running for president or, more importantly, running for U.S. Senate statewide, it tends to have a Republican tinge to the overall dynamic. I think what Cooper was able to do so successfully for so many years was at the state level to make North Carolina lean slightly Democratic. Now the real test is, can he take that statewide dynamic and layer it into a federal office? Yes, they're both the same electorate, but slightly different in terms of its dynamics. And I think that was the hope that national Democrats had in wanting Roy Cooper to get into the race and to be the kind of candidate that can really thread the needle of North Carolina politics, play well in the rural areas, be competitive in kind of the urban suburbs, run the central cities like Charlotte, like Raleigh, up in terms of numbers, and be able to tip things to that 51-49 Democratic advantage in this state.
Jacob, Roy Cooper launched his bid for Senate, or announced his bid for Senate, not on TV and not in a radio ad, but with a message directly to potential voters on social media. I think it was YouTube, could have been Instagram, I don't remember. Is this where future election battles will be won or lost, on social media and not on mainstream media?
Really good question. As someone who studies legacy media, I feel more and more unimportant every day, which is fine with me. And I think that it is the future, because that's where younger and younger generations are increasingly turning to for their media. TV ads still matter. Radio ads still matter, because the electorate is a bit older. You know, voters tend to be on the older side, and they tend to still listen into those legacy media kinds of outlets. When that changes, the campaigns will change. And I think we're starting to see that going on, where campaigns are doing everything they can to reach all of the different segments of the electorate. And that means using different platforms.
And since we're talking about this potentially being the most expensive race in the country in the history of Senate races, how much less expensive is it to put your advertising on, whether it's video advertising or just block little tile ads on social media or on YouTube or on websites, than it is to buy a big television campaign? How much less expensive is that?
The answer is, it depends. It depends on, you know, what your reach is on different social media platforms, how many you're hitting, how many, you know, exposures you're purchasing, and what media market you have to advertise in. Sometimes it makes sense to go on TV or the radio. Sometimes it does not make sense. I mean, there are some markets where there just aren't TV ads. New York City market is one of those. It's just cost prohibitive. So all candidate advertising is done radio or now social media. So it varies, I guess, is the way to say that.
And since you've been focusing in your career on legacy media, of which this is one of the outlets, broadcasters make a ton of money. Commercial broadcasters make a ton of money during political season. And in North Carolina, it's always political season. We have an election every year. Radio has to sell candidates' commercials at their lowest published rate. Television does not. It's a concept I have never understood. But commercial broadcasters accept ads not only from candidates and their campaigns, but from special interest groups and PACs at the full rate. So should these stations be reading the handwriting on the wall? Should they be preparing for fallow times ahead in campaign seasons as these ads gravitate toward much less expensive social media?
I think we're headed there. It's not yet. And also, campaigns are, not to deride them too much, but they're paranoid. They do everything that they think might possibly give them an advantage. And so if they can afford it, they're going to do everything. If they have to make hard choices, they're going to go with the platform that gives them the biggest bang for their buck. But if they can afford it, expect to see them absolutely everywhere.
Wow. And that includes social media. We can't get away from it, can we? It's growing. It's expanding like kudzu. You don't know about kudzu because you're in Buffalo. We're talking.
Did you know about it? Well, I haven't seen it.
I'll send you some. We're talking about political advertising and the tenor of our politics and our ads this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Let me see where we were here. I got all lost in the facts.
Mike, I was going to mention, and it's not just on traditional, you know, local television. You're also seeing ads move on cable networks. I was watching, for whatever reason, a Kentucky basketball game, and there was an ad nationally for a Kentucky Republican U.S. Senate candidate. I'm in North Carolina. I don't vote in Kentucky, but for some reason, they felt like, hey, I got eyeballs. I got eyeballs out of Kentucky. I'm going to drop this money on a cable network for that opportunity. So the amount of money will fill the void of whatever advertising on different venues you want.
And it also strikes me that radio is very different from television in terms of how it affects the consumers of those products. And social media is a whole different animal. Are messages being tailored differently? Are the words that are being used we know that they can very specifically target users and the algorithms take care of the rest, but are they changing the way they communicate in any way on these special platforms? Jacob.
To an extent, yes. They tend to be longer form. You know, when you're buying a radio or TV ad, usually you're talking about a 30-second or a 1-minute spot. So you can get these longer form ads on a social media platform. I don't know how much tailoring they can do because they aren't like a letter to the mailbox that can be to an individual. Every campaign has to expect that once they go up on the airwaves or on the internet, the other campaign is going to have access to that too. And so there's going to be these questions if you have a message for one audience and a different message for a different audience. So you could tailor it a little bit, but they still think of these things as broadcast ads in particular.
And I suppose the same is true with people who watch live television, maybe channel surf during the commercials, but mostly they stick around to the commercials or go to the kitchen and get something to drink or something to eat. But when something comes on YouTube and I can skip it, I do. So do we have any idea how effective advertising on these platforms can be? And I have 20 seconds. Jacob.
They can be, but it's not clear whether they're a replacement for other types of ads.
Okay. Well, we're going to come back and we're going to hear some attack ads. We're going to hear one attack ad. And talk a little bit more about the effectiveness of those ads and more when Charlotte Talks continues. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about political advertising and political campaigns with Michael Bitzer, professor of politics and history at Catawba College, and Jacob Neuheisel, associate professor of political science at the University at Buffalo. Michael, although we could not find or get our hands on a Roy Cooper ad for his Senate campaign, we did get our hands on a campaign commercial for the GOP's Michael Whatley, which aired during the primaries. Although the Democratic frontrunner Roy Cooper was not yet officially Whatley's opponent, Whatley went after the jugular.
Irina Zarutska was murdered because of Roy Cooper. Roy Cooper pushed a woke agenda of cashless bail, releasing dangerous repeat offenders like DeCarlos Brown Jr. Under Roy Cooper, DeCarlos Brown Jr. was arrested and released 14 times. While DeCarlos Brown Jr. was out on Cooper's cashless bail, he stabbed an innocent woman to death. Roy Cooper has her blood on his hands.
So before we talk about the content of that ad, why go after somebody who's not yet your opponent, Dr. Bitzer?
Well, the Democratic primary was basically a coronation of Cooper. So it was, by everybody's analysis, going to be Roy Cooper as the Democratic nominee. I think what that does is send a very clear signal of what Whatley's campaign will use over the next several months as their major attack against Cooper to try and tie him to that dynamic. If you look at other Whatley campaign ads during the primary, it was Donald Trump at the beginning, Donald Trump in the middle, and Donald Trump at the end. And that is a kind of classic. If Trump wins North Carolina, candidates usually try and latch on to them. The problem is that in a midterm election year, the president's party suffers. And so whether that's going to be coattails or whether that's going to be an anchor, I think what we're seeing with that particular attack ad against Cooper by Whatley is very much they're sending the signal, this is what we're going to fight this campaign over.
The content of that commercial was not strictly true. It's pretty complicated, but it was not strictly true. Michael, does that matter?
I think oftentimes facts get in the way of campaign advertising and campaign messaging. And while, you know, you can spin things as you want to spin them to your advantage. And thus lies the power of campaign advertising and, you know, the truth be damned at times.
Yeah, well, that's my next question, Jacob. Do ads that stretch the truth, either about the candidate or about their opponent, work more effectively than those ads that are strictly based on verifiable facts?
I don't know that they necessarily work better. They're riskier. There is some evidence of backlash effects against things that are overly negative or, you know, leave out things strategically. So they are riskier in that respect, but I don't know that they're necessarily less effective. I think voters see negativity and sometimes the details get lost in the shuffle.
Well, they say that a lie can travel halfway around the world before the truth has got its boots on, and that misinformation outruns correction of that misinformation. Would the same then be true for campaign ads? Lie all you will, because no one's going to catch up to the truth is not going to catch up to you.
Yeah, that's probably generally true. You know, there are salient examples where it can be a negative for a candidate to go lean really hard into a lie. But, you know, we're in an era of Trump where it seems like those things never catch up with him. So I guess it depends on the candidate, and it depends on, you know, how good they are at avoiding things. There was some recent research that suggests that, you know, things like apologies or walking back something are actually more of a negative than sticking to your guns. And that's not terribly positive from a little D Democratic perspective.
To underline the what you said, Michael, earlier about that ad that we played from Whatley, kind of telegraphing the direction the campaign is likely to take as it heads toward November. Whatley also brought up the murder of Irina Zarutska during an interview during the primary campaign.
What happened to Irina is barbaric, and her family has, you know, my and my entire team's utmost sympathies. And I want them to know, you know, I'm running to make sure that no other family has to endure this kind of a horrific tragedy.
This was an act of random violence, but if Cooper's policies, moves to eliminate cash bail for certain offenses and attempts to reduce unnecessary pretrial detention, among others, if those policies are partially to blame, well, then so is the lack of available mental health treatment and the lack of resources for the courts, for the district attorney's office, for jails, which are controlled by money allotted by a Republican-controlled legislature that seems not to want to do any of those things. Is that too complicated for most voters to contemplate, Michael? Or would that be a strategy that the Democrats should employ against these ads coming their way?
I think you oftentimes see advertising present half of the story, and that half of the story fits the model and the messaging that they want to present. Yes, things are complicated. Yes, there are multiple threads going on behind one horrific issue such as this, but you need to focus on the message. You've got to get the tone out there. You've got to get the what you want voters to be thinking about. And if you try to muddy the waters, the voters will say, I don't know what's going on. Why should I care about this issue? And I think what campaigns want to do is to make very clear boundaries, and they will use the facts to their benefit, and anything that doesn't benefit them just doesn't get mentioned.
I think it's safe to say, unless you've been living under a rock, everybody in North Carolina knows who Roy Cooper is. At least they've heard of Roy Cooper. They've heard his name. He was a popular governor. Not everyone outside of elite Republican circles, however, knows Michael Whatley. He's never run for political office. Roy Cooper's never lost. Michael Whatley won the Republican primary, but what does he have to do now to introduce himself to independents, Michael?
I think that's going to be the real test case to see, you know, we've got this party loyalty going on, but where are the folks, and particularly how are they thinking about big issues, and how can Whatley's campaign appeal to those concerns, those policies that that small sliver of persuadable voters out there are thinking about? And right now, the issues seem to be economic. You know, we're going to hear affordability as kind of the catchphrase for this year's economic-driven dynamics. But he's also got to contend with a potentially unpopular president. And presidential approval ratings, along with economic dynamics, tend to give us a pretty clear picture who's going to benefit in a political environment like this.
This is a pretty closely divided state, Jacob. They say we're purple, but who knows? And it's probably 49-51 in one direction or the other. And we've certainly seen instances, particularly when Donald Trump is running, where the Republicans will say, I'm him. Vote for me. So should this campaign by Michael Whatley, if you want to reach independents, at least, because everybody in the Republican Party is probably going to vote for you, should they be running ads that focus on Trump? Something like, I know you don't know me, but Trump knows me. He likes me. You like Trump. So vote for me.
I think that there's a really fine line that candidates have to walk in these particular circumstances. They're worried about two things. They're worried about winning independents, and they're worried about abstention among the base. The base is going to want to hear things like, I like Trump, I like his policies, I would support Trump in Washington were I to be elected. But that's not necessarily what independents, which is disproportionately where you're going to draw those persuadable voters from, that's not necessarily what they're going to want to hear. So candidates here have to walk a bit of a tightrope where they risk losing from both ends if they engage in that strategy.
Michael Whatley has Donald Trump's endorsement, Michael. And Trump is no fading violet when it comes to talking smack about people he doesn't like or people who are his opponents. And he likes others who follow his lead in that style of campaigning and talking about people. So in addition to this likely being the most expensive Senate race in the history of the country, is it also likely to be the nastiest race in the history of the country?
Well, North Carolina has experiences in both. And, you know, we've had a lot of in-migration folks coming into North Carolina, but I would drop two names, Hunt Helms. And that U.S. Senate race was probably one of the most divisive U.S. Senate races, at least in this state's political history. I think we'll probably, you know, recognize that we're getting close to that level, but it is going to be intensive because North Carolina plays such a key role in determining who's going to control the majority in the U.S. Senate come next January. If this seat flips to the Democrats, that means that they get closer and closer to majority status. They've got to have a lot of dominoes to fall in their direction in other states. But North Carolina is probably seen as the best pickup opportunity for Democrats to work their way back towards 51-49 control of the U.S. Senate.
According to CNN, North Carolina was number one on the list of the most expensive United States Senate races ever back in 2020. $242 million was on tap to be spent that year. That was the Tom Tillis-Cal Cunningham race. In that race, Democrats spent, I think, $28 million. The Republicans spent $12 million. Tell us one. In 2022, the race between Republican Ted Budd and Democrat Sherry Beasley. Beasley spent nearly $38.5 million, while Budd spent over $14 million. Budd won. That money was spent by candidates and their parties and not outside sources. There was more money coming in from outside. In this state, Michael, if you're a Democrat, can money move the needle?
Money can move the needle, but I think it needs to be thought of in multiple prongs, one of them being the messaging, the campaign advertising, but there's a more fundamental component, particularly in North Carolina, and that is the ground game. Getting the voters, connecting with them, you know, pounding the pavement to knock on doors and get the presence to the voters. You know, turnout is everything. That's what we're going to be talking about over the next several months. And Democrats have been behind registered Republicans in terms of turnout in this state. It is consistent. Election after election, the 2020, 2022 elections, 2024 elections, registered Republicans are 5 to 6 points ahead of where registered Democrats are in terms of turnout. So part of all that money descending, yeah, it's going to be on the airwaves and social media. But if Democrats have a strategy to pump money into getting their voters out who are reliable Democratic voters, that's the dynamic that's going to make a difference, I think, in this state.
Jacob, WUNC reports experts predict $400 to $500 million will be spent on North Carolina's U.S. Senate race as national groups flood the state with cash. Politico says that some strategists have predicted it could be closer to the first $1 billion Senate race ever. Which do you think is closer to the truth?
That's a great question. I think it's just going to be an expensive race all around. And I buckle up to echo something that Michael said earlier in the show. It's coming. Okay. It's going to be a very expensive one.
Cut the baby in half, three quarters of a $1 billion.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Knowing what you know, Michael, about North Carolina politics, what should the candidates' perspective messages be as we head toward November? Which messages or themes might resonate most with the biggest block of voters? Because that block is the independents in the middle.
Again, I would go to kind of a two-pronged strategy for both campaigns. Certainly, this is shaping up to be a traditional midterm year. That means the president's party is going to suffer at the polls, particularly for congressional seats. And with this U.S. Senate race, I think you're fighting against national dynamics that have become so influential in state level, even local level politics now, that you're going to have to ride the wave of nationalized politics. Democrats are going to use a very familiar name, and that is Trump, because they want to tie Whatley to Trump if Trump is deeply unpopular. For Republicans, they can use the Trump name to motivate, but they've got to realize that if that persuadable small segment middle ground doesn't like Trump, they have to come up with something else in terms of a campaign message and theme. And maybe that's why we're seeing the hitting on law and order. That is a classic kind of Republican campaign message theme.
And yet crime is on the decline. This was the first year in state history, Michael, that the number of registered Republicans in the state eclipsed the number of registered Democrats. How might that fact come into play as we head toward November?
Registration is important, but more importantly to me, it's do those registered voters show up? And again, I go back to the turnout rates. And the big question right now for North Carolina politics is basically 40% of the voter registration pool are unaffiliateds. They are not independents. They are not, you know, the kind of classic, you know, independent-minded people. They are typically partisans, but they've been masked because they don't like the political party labels. And unaffiliateds tend to have 5 to 6 points lower turnout than Democrats. So again, Messaging is going to motivate. Messaging is going to energize. But it's all about the ground game at this point.
So I have 30 seconds left. And we've seen Donald Trump. We've seen J.D. Vance come to North Carolina several times. And you can expect that they'll be coming here in the coming months as well to campaign. Are they just speaking to the choir? Or are they changing hearts and minds, Michael?
They're mostly speaking to the choir to get the choir up and singing the praises that they need to be singing for November's general election.
Michael Bitzer is a professor of politics and history and the director of the Center for North Carolina Politics and Public Service at Catawba College, right down the road. And also right up the road at the University of Buffalo is Dr. Jacob Neuheisel, associate professor of political science there. Thank you both for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.